Thank you for letting me be here. And the reason that I'm here is because of three men. Keith Forster mentioned to me over a year ago, "Why don't you speak?" And I said, "I don't see that as my gift, and I'm not sure I have much to say." But as time went on, one of our other members, who isn't here today, asked me about prayer. And I found that in explaining how I live out my prayer life, which is really grace, it seemed to be an encouragement to her. And thirdly, I'm here because of Jim Jones, who has chosen to share at one point during the past year a little bit of his own journey with me. And I found it so inspiring and so forgiving that I decided I would say yes to Keith's invitation. The three men who have helped are Keith, and when I offered at Word and Life steering committee meeting, Tom said, "Go for it." And then Bob has been an invaluable resource without which this presentation wouldn't even have happened. And so I want to thank them. And fourthly, Jude, thank you. Thank you for this beautiful, beautiful prayer. In a way, I think we could just can my notes and discuss this, because it says it all. I want to read something before we get started from Richard Rohr. Many of you know that he has a website that offers kind of a thought for the day. Every day I get it over the internet. And I think it's very appropriate for the topic of grace. And I'd like to just share it with you. He's working off Romans 8:28, and he says, "God cooperates with those who love by turning everything to their own good." St. Paul says here in this reading that God both initiates and cooperates in all human growth. All we can offer is the goodwill of love. God works together with us, which means both our workings, God's and ours, are crucial. We are real partners. Every moment, God is trying to expand our freedom to love. God is forever trying to make our choices more alive, more vital, more clear, more true. So much so that God even uses our mistakes and our sins in that one providential direction. Nothing at all is wasted. Nothing. If that's not the providence of God, what else would be providential? God seems to be working for our wholeness, for our liberation, for our integrity, probably more than we are. At least that's what the saints always say. And this is from his Morning Today Radical Grace Daily Meditations. And the mantra that he proposes for the day is, "Jesus came to show me how to be more human." What did you all think of this chapter? What was there any one point that really either jumped out at you or gave you pause?
The banquet at the end in
Babette's feast.
Covered everything.
Anybody else? Keith.
How easily humans slip away from what Jesus really was trying to teach us.
How easily humans slip away from what Jesus was trying to teach us.
Yeah. And turns it into, I forgot what Moore said, that instead of hearing what Jesus said, we include it into our own little lifestyle and cover it up.
We include it into our own little lifestyle. I think that's true. Anyone else? Anne?
Richard Rohr said that Jesus had a male body. A feminine soul.
A male body but a feminine soul. Anybody agree with that or disagree? He was probably both in the sense of his spirit, because he is the Son of God and we are made in God's image. I'll advance this. Grace is rightly defined as that which confers on our souls a new life. That is, a sharing in the life of God. And this is from the Baltimore Catechism himself. However, it's also repeated in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. How many of you remember the definitions of sanctifying grace?
I just remember the milk bottle.
Explain that, Tom.
Well, the illustrated Baltimore Catechism that I remember showed us with milk bottles, and if the milk bottle got dirty, it was sinful. And they had gray milk bottles, and they had a black milk bottle for mortal sin. You guys don't remember the Baltimore Catechism?
Yeah. Grace is like snow on a donkey.
Snow on a donkey. Yeah. That's promising.
He got that from Augustine, actually.
Yeah. When I was doing some research for this presentation, Augustine seems to be about where the concept and notion of grace begins. Now, there's obviously allusion to it in the Old Testament. The word grace is used approximately 170 times in the Bible. That depends on the version. There's a little bit of difference between the King James and between the Catholic. And interestingly, Jesus never uses the word grace. However, Luke does when he's talking about his youthfulness, and he says, "And Jesus advanced in wisdom and age and grace." What does that mean? What does that mean for Jesus to advance in grace?
Matured.
Sorry, matured.
In all of those aspects, while they were in him, that's my version, as they are in all of us from day one, he grew in wisdom and knowledge and grace like we have a possibility.
Okay, did everybody hear Tony? She has a software. Okay, Tony.
I think that it also, on the same line, is that he understood it. He accepted it. He knew about it. He was awakened to it.
The
grace. Okay. That the grace was all around.
Okay.
Everyone. Yes. I think he understood that.
Okay. And that his call was a constant one to his disciples and apostles and to his family. There's more. There it is.
I think we usually think of grace in terms of physical movement.
Physical movement.
Yeah, but it would also be behavior, personality, congeniality. That would all be sort of incorporated into a grace.
Behavior and good. Roy, did you have your hand up?
Well, I'm just thinking of Mary. She accepted the angels. You know, gift there. I think that was a grace, and she just accepted it without saying, "Oh, I can't do this," or whatever. other people have done.
Nancy?
I think that statement contradicts what we often learn, is that Jesus knew everything ahead of time that was going to happen to him in his life.
Did everybody hear what Nancy said? That Jesus knew ahead of time everything. It took me a long time to get past that. Any other comment on Jesus and his growing in grace?
Mary, I like to think of the word graciousness.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to say it all, including the physical grace, the naturalness of reaching out to other people.
That's lovely. Thank you. Tom?
He got it from his mom.
And his dad.
The angel came to Mary and said, "Hail, full of grace." That's where it came from.
Thank you, God. Interestingly, in that little clause, he doesn't say, "Hail, Mary."
Yeah.
He says, "Hail, full of grace." And doesn't that apply to each of us?
Mm-hmm.
Hail Jane, full of grace. Hail Liz, full of grace. Dawn, full of grace. John, full of grace. This is for all of us, not just Mary, because we are all called and invited to birth Jesus every day. Any more comments? Christine.
Building on what Tom said, his grandma was Anne, and Anne is the Hebrew for grace.
That's lovely. Anne is the Hebrew for grace, and that was the name of Jesus' grandmother. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Anybody else have anything to share? The central positive theme of the Bible: divine, unmerited generosity. Everywhere available, totally given, usually undetected as such, and even often undesired. I'd like to share a little bit about the undesired. When I told my parents that I was seriously thinking about entering religious life, my mother, who was Catholic, was less than supportive. This was back in the late 50s. I went to a small private Catholic girls' school in a little town, well, it's a big town, but Shreveport, Louisiana. It was the second only to New Orleans, which was down south. Shreveport is up in the northwest corner of Louisiana, and the state is almost divided in two along the middle of it. You know, it's shaped like a boot.
Mm-hmm.
And if you cut a line right across the middle, the northern part of Louisiana is mostly Protestant, mainly Baptist, and the south is Cajun, French, mostly Catholic. So being a Catholic in Shreveport, where I grew up, was not an expected event. It was a circumstance, and my mother was Catholic, my father was not. And I had struggled with the idea of a vocation for several years, and I got this wonderful letter from my boyfriend. And it was something about, and I can't remember the words, but the whole idea was, I think God is calling you, do what you think is best. So, with that in mind, excuse me, my allergies are kicking in here. I said something to my mother about it, and we had a few talks about it, and she was not in favor of my doing it. But she said, okay, if you insist on doing this, I will, you know, you have my blessing, but I want to send you to Europe first. Mm-hmm. Now, my mother was seriously, seriously impaired health-wise for most of her, in fact, for all of her life. I grew up with a lot of nannies giving care because she was hospitalized. Nobody wants to be sick. Nobody wants to be sick for extended periods of time. It happens. We all have family members. We all have illnesses ourselves. Anyway, she said, my father and I will send you. Do you need help? There's a lady in the back. Do you need help? Okay. She said, I'm going to send you to Europe because I want, hopefully, this idea to get out of your head. And secondly, you'll never see Europe if you go to the convent. Well, it turned out she was wrong on both conclusions. It did swing me a bit. It was wonderful. I was on one of these tours. My sister and I both went together. One of these tours, you know, that they had planned in those days for college kids. And you spend 3 days in Paris and 2 days in Brussels. You know, the tour, you're on a big bus. And it was all girls, so there was lots of chit-chat. And I came home, and we went over on a ship. And on the ship, I was out on the back deck, very close to the stern. I was by myself, and it was at night. And I was really, really struggling with the idea of, is this right for me? Isn't it right for me? What to do? Now, in those days, I need to say this, vocations were considered something that if you didn't act on them right then, you would lose it. I don't know if any of you girls who went to Catholic school, Ginny, you're nodding your head, Jane, a little bit. The idea was, you know, seize the grace, seize the day, go. So I thought, jeepers, am I fooling around with God's grace? Am I messing with it? Well, I was praying on the back deck, as I said, and I heard this voice in my mind. It doesn't really matter what you do. Now, I was stunned. And I kept walking to the back of the stern area to try to hear more, to try to bring that voice back. And it didn't come. And that's when I found that the resentment issue. I was pretty well sure I should do that. And now God is giving me the option of freedom. And I was scared. I didn't want freedom. I wanted what I wanted God to say was, yes, definitely, religious life is where you should be. And God didn't. And I resented it. I wanted the security of knowing absolutely positively that I was at all times where God wanted me to be, doing what God wanted me to do. And religious life, back in the late 50s and early 60s, offered that security, that confidence, that obedience, that whatever you were doing at that time, if your superior had ordained it, you were doing what you were supposed to be doing. You could do no more for God other than, you know, at that point, sweeping the floor, doing the dishes, whatever it was, that was the greatest thing that we could be doing. Anybody else have an example of resented grace? Maybe not chasing God off the back of a ship. Anybody have anything you recall, an example in your own life? Oh, and Tony, yes.
Well, mine is kind of the opposite.
Can you say a little louder?
Mine was kind of the opposite. I was meditating. It's the Libra of the days of my meditation, and the voice comes in and says, you're doing the right thing. And I was planning on stopping.
Thank you. Anybody else? Anna?
My husband's son was going through a very similar quandary about what to do, and asking everybody, and had a ministry in Australia and was going to either do that or stay here and go back, and he was going back and forth and back and forth, should I do this, should I not? He had people praying for him, and same voice came through, same kind of message, it doesn't matter. And I remember when I heard that, I thought, but he thought the same thing. What a message to get. It doesn't matter. But the message was, it doesn't matter. I will be with you no matter what you choose.
Exactly. I didn't finish that part, but thank you for adding that. Yeah. I will be with you whatever you choose.
Yeah.
And that kind of freedom I'm really realizing and growing into is constantly, daily, every day, everywhere available, totally given, and usually undetected as such, and often even undesired, especially when we want and need surety. Christine.
This is about me. In the conversations with God, they say that God doesn't care what we do. It's just like when you send your children out to the yard to play, you don't really care if they play in the sand or if they ride their bikes or if they're just, you are going to be watching them and caring for them. But you don't care what they do, just so long as they are doing what they choose. So our will for ourselves is God's will for us.
Thank you. Anybody else? Jim, I thought Jim came first.
I think this addresses the fact that a religious vocation isn't necessarily better than a layman vocation.
Yes.
And you can do the same work of God as a mother or father or fellow worker or whatever as a priest or a nun. And it's just a matter in which you choose to exhibit that generosity and grace. And so.
That philosophy, that thought that Jim just shared, was not prevalent when I was growing up. It was, religious. The priest is second to God. Then the sisters. The sisters. And even in the sisters, there's a hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
The cloistered sisters,
mm-hmm.
who spend much of their day in prayer and most of their time in silence, that was even higher than the what we call the semi-cloistered or active order. Now, I did mention to my mother about the fact that I was thinking about being a cloistered nun. She nipped that right in the bud with one sentence. She said, "Mary, you can't keep your mouth shut." My mother was very wise. She may have been not terribly healthy, but she was wise. And so I did put that one aside. And then I realized that there was a part of me, maybe it was because of her many illnesses and maybe it was just where I was in life, but I really realized I wanted to be a nurse. And so I chose a religious order. There was a group in Shreveport that had a hospital, and I chose that order. And the rest will unfold. Anybody else have a comment on uninvited grace? Keith?
As a very young seminarian going into high school, I just wasn't that developed yet, where
none of us were.
where I was praying and that I found myself resenting it. Oh, now I'm stuck because I've got all this approval for going to the seminary.
There is that. In my class of, I had about 53, 55 girls in our high school class. 10 of us chose to enter religious life.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big thing in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And it was always the uppermost, the goal of perfection.
Yeah.
Perfection. And what, it was a different reading of the Bible that I read many years later when it says, and this is the old English word, be ye perfected, mm-hmm. not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
That was hard to grow out of for me. Ed.
When I was in my early, about as a teenager, I entered the seminary without really being sure,
mm-hmm.
but I was told that was okay.
Sure.
And when we got there, I remember the first week, one of the priests said, he said, it doesn't matter whether you were tricked into being, whether you came of your own volition, or whether somebody walked you up to the gate with a gun at your head. He said, forget all that. You're here. Take it from here.
St. Thomas Aquinas said, if you arrive at the gate, that is a sure sign you have a vocation.
Completely different context, but all this discussion is making me think of a minister I heard mention that he personally had discovered God in seminary, and that that was a very unusual situation.
I agree with you, Lee. I think it was after I left, and I was in for 16 years. This wasn't something I was just toying with. I really, really, really tried. And sometimes you get to the gate, and then you have to go back out. But one thing I wanted to do, anybody have anything more? Yeah, I'm sorry.
I'm going to say that for years, all my life, I obsessed about doing the right thing. That was pounded into me. And I got to a point in life, late, but I finally arrived, where it didn't matter. And that, arriving at that, and feeling that, and living that it doesn't really matter, releases you from an awful lot of anxiety and pressure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Anna, that's what you had said. Maureen?
Well, this is true confession here today, I guess.
we are who we are. By the grace of God, we are who we are.
So when I was 18, I entered the convent as well. And I was there for 5 years. And I can remember going through that same process of thinking, you know, I could do both things, but if I don't enter now, and I was kind of involved with this guy, then I would just go that direction. But if I went in the convent, then at least I would try it out. Kind of that was my, and it was also the kind of this hierarchical idea. If you can do this, it's really the best thing to do, because you're just kind of totally giving your life, and somehow, you know, it would be better. And then this priest, just before I made final vows, I don't know whatever possessed him, or had opened up a discussion with him, and he said, you know, and I was sharing with him my dilemma, because I didn't really want to be a nun, but I really, and I, it wasn't that I didn't like it, I just didn't, I'd rather be married, actually. And so I was sharing that with him, and he said, well, a call always comes with your whole person. It doesn't just come with your head thinking, this is the best thing to do. Everything about your whole person directs you if it's a call one way or another. That was just a great revelation, and I just left, you know, quite quickly after that, realizing that, you know, I was free from that.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Gary?
I was interested in your comment, the desire for perfection. Yeah. I think there's sort of a subconscious thing that arose at least with the Council of Trent when they declared dogmatically the superiority of celibacy over marriage. That's been absorbed, I think, into the traditional Catholic perspective. And if you really want to be perfect, you don't get married.
Right. Even St. Paul says that, although he says other things too. Jim, did you have a hand up? Jim? I'm sorry, did you have a hand up? I guess. Anybody else over here? Okay, we're going to move right along then. What strikes you about this picture? First of all, can any of you guess who it is? And Tom, I think you may know. You don't. It's a relative?
I said it's not a relative.
It's not.
Not that you know.
The wonderful thing about it for me is that he is holding a cat.
Yeah.
A cat. Anybody have any idea who it might be? It's not St. Francis. Sorry? Colin Kiltmore. Okay. What about this? Anybody recognize him?
Lennon?
No, close. It does look like him, but it isn't. This guy is Gustav Klimt. And there he is. And there he is. How differently would we judge and assess if we saw that on the street, that guy, and then if we saw this guy? Which one would we be drawn to? Okay. The picture that he has done that absolutely stopped me in my tracks when I first saw it is this one. And I have a couple, maybe, John, would you help me hold it? I'm sorry that it isn't as bold as the whole hanger. This is called the Tree of Life. This is expectation. This is the Tree of Life, and this is fulfillment. Both beginning and end are women. There is the woman is seems to me she is holding or hugging a man. In the middle is the Tree of Life. And every curlicue is part of the grace that we live into, through, and out of in our own lives. To me, down here at the bottom of it are all sorts of little figures. They're teeny tiny. But to me, that represents both our roots of family and environment and our communities. The community of Ordered Life, of Santa Barbara, California, United States, the globe, and the universe. The wonderful thing for me is that he has included so many different facets of humanity. The dress that the woman is wearing is Asian. She has what looks to me a little bit Egyptian features. Over here, this woman does not look that. She looks more Indian. The man, because we can see, this is very dark skin from Africa. And yet all of us are part of the curlicues of life and trees. Trees have been long, long friends of mine. And when I saw this, the Tree of Life, I realized it's also the Tree of Grace. So I'll put the thing
in. Mary?
Yes, can I?
Is that the original coloring that he used?
No, he is brighter.
Well, he uses very vibrant
colors. Vibrant colors. It's a poster. It's just a poster. Yeah, turn it the other way, John, if you would. I asked Ann to help me with the pronunciation of the palace in Brussels where Klimt painted this. And she said some word, and I just looked at her, and I said, America, please, can you say it for us, Anne? Stocklet?
I don't remember.
S-T-O-C-L-E-T.
S-T-O-C-L-E-T?
And you said something about how the Belgians would have said it. Something like that. I couldn't get my tongue around it. But isn't it interesting that somebody who... looks like that could produce this. And isn't this true of all of us? Each one of us. We're all different. We all are producing grace. We're living grace, we are producing it. No, sorry. Okay. Any questions? Any more comments? Jenny?
Mary, it just strikes me how that symbol of the spiral is the basic symbol.
Yes. I've been captivated by that. Moore uses the symbol of a spiral a lot. Mm-hmm. Martha?
In New Zealand, the moorings, that's a symbol when a fern is unfurling.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that is their symbol of creation.
We have a vine in our backyard, and maybe some of you have been around a vine, that if you put your finger very close to the tendril, if you can hold it there long enough, the tendril will actually start to go around your finger. Is that grace? There's a priest, Father Ed Haynes, who also, I'm on his receiving list. He said that grace is a word that most of the young people wouldn't recognize. He would prefer, possibly Alice, with divine energy. I know you've often spoken to that, Alice. And divine energy is something we all have. And I want to invite you right now to just take your hand. Let me move ahead one. I think it's called the Emerging Science of Goodness. Keith, what it is a picture of two adult hands with two little child hands enveloped. They're holding the little hands. The big hands are holding the little hands. Take your own hands right now and put them as close as you can to each other without touching. Can you feel anything?
Warm.
Grace. Okay, move one of your hands, keep one still and move the other. Just gently. Can you feel some movement? Okay, now
magnetism.
Try pulling your hands apart very, very slowly. See how far you can go with that little magnetism. Okay. Everybody feel it? Anybody? Okay, now take your hands and do them like this. Now try. Do you feel the heat? Can you feel it farther apart? That's life, that's grace. And then we go from that to this. This is our brain. It's also a telecommunication system that somebody sent me from a town, we'll go unnamed, but it's quite a large town, and it's not Santa Barbara. But this is often, I think, what happens. Our circuits get crossed, tangled, messed up, and because we tend to move more with our heads than our hands and hearts, this is sometimes what it looks like. So back in the beginning, any comment on this? Somebody said this is the inside of a computer, and there is that. There is the beauty of creation, and again, I'm going back to Genesis, but just briefly, the grace in a jellyfish. How many of you have been to the aquarium in Monterey? Okay, almost at least half of you, maybe three-fourths. Have you noticed the little jelly exhibit? There's also one at the Long Beach Aquarium. This little jellyfish has no eyes and no brain. And yet, it is full of life and beauty and the grace that God gave it in creating it. God moves on to freezing. This is an actual picture of a wave that is frozen as it was cresting and coming down. I think it's amazing they captured it in the picture, but it's now rigid. What looks like the blue stuff with the lines is actually the water. And then grace in our own neighborhoods. There's a house not far from where I live that every spring, especially after we've had wonderfully heavy rains, the oxalis blooms. Lots of people think oxalis is a weed. I love it. I just love the bright yellow. And it opens every day. It's heliotropic. It opens to the sun. And the little faces just smile. And I think it's a real example of God's grace. And then God created animals. Aren't these cute? This is from China. There were 14 little pandas born within a very short period of time. And I just love the one over here getting into the computer.
He's a techie type.
And then coming along in creation, we get God the Master Builder. Which one's God? Dick, I'm sorry?
Right.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said something. Which one is God? The man is looking at the plans.
The little one.
The little one, yeah. She's just standing there watching. The man has his ideas about how to take the plan and reassemble, I guess it's a table. Mm. She's just watching. And then we get new life. I borrowed that expression from Mary Becker because when her first grandbaby was born, she said to me, I was congratulating her, and she said, it's so wonderful to see the gift of new life. Imagine the baby's, what, two now, Mary?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then kids grow, and they explore, and they figure out they're in motion, why not make what's around us in motion as well? How many mothers have scooped up a whole roll on the floor? And then we have more children. And then the little girl says, the one who's holding her baby brother, dear God, thank you for the baby brother, but what I prayed for was a puppy. Choice. And this is one of my favorite slides. This is my great nephew. The other children are my great nieces and nephews. The gift of wonder at the miracle of running water. All of my niece and her husband's children have a thing for water, and I guess most babies do. This little guy is, I've tracked his eyes with a ruler. He is looking at the gushing water, and you can see the wonder. And isn't this true of all of us? The gushing of grace. And sometimes we are just simply struck. He's not saying anything, he's just got his mouth open. The wonder of running water. One of the things that was very important to me as I was growing up was music. And I studied piano for 12 years and then organ for two. And then I played as a in the convent for many years as the each hospital or each school that our sisters had, there was an organ, of course, in the chapel, and they tried to put a sister in this place. That wasn't the reason necessarily for designating where someone would go, but they did try to have music in everyone. And I've asked Gail to explain a little bit to us this slide, and the reason I'm reading it is because Summer maybe can't see it. Bach gave us God's word. Mozart gave us God's laughter. Beethoven gave us God's fire. God gave us music that we might pray without words. And Gail is going to demonstrate something about music and both harmony and dissonance because we have both aspects in our lives. And I want to thank Tom because he brought something to mind yesterday for me, and that is this. You know how difficult it is to stay in the now? We're always looking ahead, looking back, looking forward, sideways, whatever. Tom reminded us yesterday in a meeting, music keeps us in the now. Because once the note is played, it's gone. And you can think about it in your head, but music grounds us. And Gail, would you?
A few years ago, I think Alice asked me to demonstrate something, and it occurred to me that the elements of relationship are all in music as well as in between people. And when you have tones that are close together, sometimes it's harsh to the ears. Sometimes we feel that in relationship. And then it evolves to something harmonic. And so I noticed in Blessed Are They that that's really evident in the beginning of the piece.
Mm-hmm.
everybody get the concept?
And I guess one more little thing.
Please.
If the entire piece were in thirds, it wouldn't be as interesting.
Before the break, so I'll move ahead quickly. One of the things that also was very important to me and has continued to be so are pets. I had a pet. When we were growing up, we had a totally black cat. My father was very tall. He was 6'2". And no matter where my dad went, when he was in the kitchen and opened the refrigerator, that cat would do a figure of eight around his feet, and it used to drive my dad crazy. I named the cat Morpheus because I had read a book that Morpheus was the king of sleep in mythology. So I named the cat Morpheus because other than looking in the refrigerator when Dad was there, the cat seemed to spend most of his time sleeping. It wasn't until later that I began to realize the grace that we receive through and in animals. I had a cat for almost 16 years. And more times than not, that cat was the person of God to me. It didn't care if I gained weight and my hair looked awful. It wanted to be with me. And every evening, that cat would come and sit in my lap. Towards the end of its life, it couldn't jump very well. It was very old. So I put a little footstool next to the chair in which I sat. He would go and stand on the footstool, look back at me at the dining room table, and meow. And I knew what he was saying was, come, spend time with me. And when he got much, much older, I realized he was very close to death, and I felt that perhaps in some way, just as people do, he was hanging on because he knew I loved him so much. And I held him on a Sunday night, and I said, Sam, you have been a wonderful pet. I really love you. I will miss you incredibly, but if you need to go, it's okay. I took him down to his little bed. He did not get out of bed the next day or the following day. I took water, I moistened my fingers and put them on his lips. He didn't even have the strength to hardly lick it. And then we did put him to sleep. I think sometimes we need to be able to know when to say, you've been such a wonderful friend, such a wonderful companion, you can go. And Alan and Dolores, my hunch is you probably experienced this with your mom and your sister. You can go. It's time for a break. Thank you all. Oh, before you leave, I just wanted to make...